I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our guest today, New Hampshire Transportation Commissioner Christopher Clement, begins the new year pretty much the way he ended the last, urging the legislature to find more money for roads and bridges. And there are several new bills toward that end. One getting the most attention is from Republican Senator Jim Rausch for an immediate 4-cent increase in the gas tax and tying future growth to the rate of inflation. Another Senate proposal would add a surcharge to vehicle registrations for hybrids and electric cars. And a House bill would raise the per-gallon tax on vehicles that use alternative fuels like compressed natural gas. In addition to these, there are ongoing efforts to expand the state's gambling options, with a dedicated amount of those proceeds going to roads. For his part, Clement says he's revenue agnostic, meaning he doesn't care where the money comes from, just that his department badly needs it as the state's infrastructure deteriorates. But while Clement's concerns are shared by many in the legislature, there's disagreement about how best to address them. Some feel a higher gas tax is the way to go. Others say the department's budget could be better managed, while still others feel there could be entirely new approaches that we haven't even looked at yet. Today in The Exchange, Transportation Commissioner Christopher Clement is with us, and let's hear from you. What priorities do you think his agency should put on the top of its list? And what can wait, given the continuing debate over funding sources? Give us a call, The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Christopher Clement, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Good morning, Laura. Thank you.
And Happy New Year, by the way.
Happy New Year to you as well.
Well, and it's been a pretty big winter so far already. Started in early December, a couple big snowstorms, then some super cold weather, then some treacherous ice over the weekend. How has this affected your department, Commissioner Clement?
We're about 40% of the way through the winter based on how we measure. We're in week 10, and we've, as of last Friday, we've expended about 51% of our winter maintenance budget. So that's where we are as of right now. But this great weather that we've had this week, where the temperature's in the 40s, is really helping. So if this continues with the warm weather, we'll be more on par.
And sure, it's winter in New Hampshire, and sure, we expect tough weather, my goodness.
Right.
But picking up on what you said, less than halfway through the winter, already spent a little more than half your winter road budget. Something seems amiss there. I mean, did you guys not plan quite properly for a typical New Hampshire winter?
No, we did. We budgeted our winter maintenance budgets between $32 and $39 million a year. And last year was actually the first year that we actually had a class line in our budget where it's actually winter maintenance. And we have, I think it was $32 million in the winter maintenance budget this year. I think that it's really predicated on Mother Nature. And, you know, you try to schedule the storms out as best you can and read Farmer's Almanac and,
right,
and so on and so forth. But, you know, I'm hopeful that we'll get caught up between now and the end of April when this starts to wind down.
A lot of people skidding out and rolling over. There was some weird stuff, right, Commissioner Clement, in terms of just how suddenly cold it got. And that meant you guys couldn't do things the way that you normally do them.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, no two storms are the same. And if you talk to the men and women that have been in the department for decades, and some of them as many as 45, 50 years, they'll tell you even this year that no two storms are alike. We had that one snowstorm a couple Fridays ago where it was, you know, well below freezing, and we couldn't actually apply salt to the roads or brine because the temperature was too cold. It was actually, when you get below 10 degrees Fahrenheit, salt does not work. So we had to wait till the following Saturday, about midday. It got up to about 24 degrees when we were able to go back out and actually scrape up the pack, you know, the hard pack on the roads. So, you know, that was one of them. Another instance last weekend on Sunday, actually, there was an area in the state. It was about, you know, 44 degrees, and this was on Sunday, and it was starting to rain, but it was also already, you know, freezing on the road, which is 44 degrees. You wouldn't expect that. So very strange events this year.
Well, and I heard that quote from Bill Boynton, your spokesman, that at some low temperature, you know, the regular salt or whatever you use, the regular road treatments don't work below 10 degrees, as you said. Hasn't somebody invented something that would work at this point? I mean, my goodness, it's 2013.
Well, actually, New Hampshire, we actually were the first ones to use road salt in the United States of America. So, and that's used elsewhere. Some, you know, out in the Midwest, Colorado area, they used cinders and that type of stuff, which is a not like salt. It's more like ashes type of material, but that has a negative environmental effect. But I think that for the most part, if people slow down and they're not distracted and they pay attention and have two hands on the wheel and give themselves, you know, ample time to get where they're going, most times people, you know, it'll be fine.
Yeah,
I think
by
that
the way.
Go ahead.
I misspoke. I said it's 2013. It's 2014.
Right,
so
right.
Still
know,
getting used to that.
I know what you meant. So I think that, you know, if you look at just the statistics this year, and I know we're getting a little off track, but if you look at accidents, and we have, you know, 9 emphasis areas. We have this Driving Towards Zero campaign, and 2 of the 9 emphasis areas that we really focus a lot on is distracted driving and impaired driving. And if you talk to my friends in the state police, Colonel Quinn and others, they'll tell you that their feeling is that a lot more people driving out there that are distracted, whether they're using a handheld device, which they shouldn't be, or if they're eating or reading a newspaper or in some cases a book or applying makeup, so on and so forth, it's a major problem. And we need to continue the effort in educating not only the adults but also the younger folks that are starting to get their license now.
Our number here in the exchange
problem.
For you to join Commissioner Clement is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Join us as we look at the state of New Hampshire's infrastructure, roads, bridges, rail, buses, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. So, Commissioner Clement, let's get into some of the funding issues that your department we'll be talking about before the legislature. And as I said, you know, you ended 2013 looking for more money. You start 2014 looking for more money. How much more do you need, Commissioner Clement?
Well, I mean, I guess you could look at it in a couple different ways. If you just look at our budget, and that's what we're governed by, or what we're driven by, in the next beginning of the next biennium, day one of the next biennium, there's a projected shortfall of $48 million negative in the highway fund. And if nothing changes, the following year goes up to $106 million negative in the highway fund. And that's not only DOT. That includes the Department of Safety and other agencies. So I've been out talking about that way in advance just to let the legislature and the governor and everyone know that we have a significant problem staring us in the face July 1st of 2015, and we need to talk about it now. So that I've been out educating about that. So that's just the operational piece of DOT. That doesn't take into account that we have Interstate 93 that we need to finish, and you've heard me say that we have we're on the final stretch on I-93. We have $250 million left on this project to finish the widening from exit 3 up to 5 and then up 5 to the split 293-93. Last year I was talking about, you know, our roads are falling apart. 37% of our roads are rated in poor condition. It's about 1,600 miles. And every year, we're going to lose 52 miles this year of fair roads that are going to drop down to the poor category. And I've been saying we need an additional $12 million more per year just so we can stay okay, not great, stay okay and start to address some of those secondary roads like the East Conway roads or the Meredith Neck roads. I met with Senator Forrester yesterday, and she has a number of roads in her district that are secondary roads, the unnumbered state routes. We have about 970 miles of unnumbered state routes that are in poor condition. So paving, we need more money for paving. Also for redless bridges, you've heard me talk about that before, saying we need an additional $15 million more per year, $15 million more per year to start to trend downward on our redless bridges. Right now we have 145 redless bridges, and by 2016, if all things remain the same, that's going to go up to 175 redless bridges. And remember, a redless bridge is one or more members that are structurally deficient, or if the bridge is functionally obsolete.
Wow. And hang on just a second, because
sure,
redless bridge has a really scary tone to it. Does that mean you shouldn't drive over it? I mean, at what point does a redless bridge become a don't drive bridge?
That's a great question. No, I mean, some redless bridges, I mean, most of them you can drive over. For example, the Sarah Mildred Long Bridge in Portsmouth. That's the bridge that's in the middle. So you have the I-95 bridge, then you have the Sarah Mildred Long, and of course the new Memorial Bridge we just replaced. So the Sarah Mildred Long Bridge in Portsmouth is the state's number one red-listed bridge. That's a red-list bridge. It's been downposted. So what happens is there will, if it has a certain weight rating, we'll keep downposting it or lowering the amount of weight that can go over that structure.
I see. So certain trucks maybe might not be able to use that bridge. They have to
That's
go somewhere
right.
else.
So today, the Sarah Mildred Long Bridge is rated at is rated at 20 tons, which is 40,000 pounds. And trucks today are around 100,000 pounds. So a fully loaded tractor-trail truck cannot go over that bridge. And you can imagine that if we ever had an event on the I-95 high-level bridge where we had to close that bridge and the truck traffic could not go over the Sarah Mildred Long Bridge, that causes problems, especially for the state of Maine, when 70% of their GDP, daily GDP, goes over the I-95 bridge. And if they don't have a redundant backup, they're out of business.
So, okay, so the red-listed bridges, that's one urgent item that you say you would not be able to attend to if you don't get the money that you feel you need. What else doesn't happen, Commissioner Clement, if funding levels just stay the same?
Well, I mean, maintenance and operations, that's another one. That's, that's $25 to $30 million a year. And if, you know, the way I'm looking at this $48 million shortfall and talking about it, if nothing changes, if we don't come to a solution, then I have to reorganize the Department of Transportation because I am not going to run a deficit. And what does that mean? And people say, well, what does that mean? That means that we're gonna stop doing certain programs and some of our workers are no longer going to be part of the department.
Programs like what?
Well, we don't know yet. We don't know yet. The short answer is we don't know yet, but it's people and programs that are going to go. And when people say, well, how many people does that $48 million equate to? And I say, well, I'm going to assume that we DOT are going to take $40 million out of the $48 million cut, and the Department of Safety would probably take the $8 million cut. That equates to about 700 people. Now, I'm sure that's not going to be the case. But, I'm from private sector. I was in manufacturing for 20 years. When you have issues, you start to work on mitigation. You don't wait till the day that the issue arises. You start to work on mitigation strategies, and that's what we're doing. Myself and senior staff, we're looking at $5 million increments. What does a $40 million cut look like? What's a $35 million cut all the way down? And that's where the people and programs come together. There would be consolidation of the department, and there would be some non-core programs, and I don't know what those are yet. I know you ask, and I'm not being evasive. I just don't know what those are yet that we would no longer do.
All right. We will talk a lot more after a short break. Some of the funding ideas that have come up, including Commissioner Clement, the idea that you folks could manage your budget differently and that might help. So we'll discuss that after a short break, and we'll start taking your calls to the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. As a public radio service, the opinions and insights of our listeners drives much of what we do at NHPR. You can make your voice heard when you become a member of our Community Advisory Board. Find out more and fill out an application at nhpr.org. More with New Hampshire's Transportation Commissioner Christopher Clement on The Exchange, and a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, an update on the West Virginia chemical spill and the safety of water supplies. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from BCM Environmental and Land Law, proud member of NOFA New Hampshire, the Granite States Organic Farming Association, online at nofanh.org. A New Hampshire magazine featuring an article on the Northern Pass Project, plus photography on the edge with Jay Philbrook. New Hampshire Magazine, where New Hampshire comes to you. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with New Hampshire DOT Commissioner Christopher Clement about the department's needs and goals for 2014 and beyond. We're talking about the status of New Hampshire's roads, bridges, other infrastructure, and what the commissioner fears may happen if his department doesn't get more funding. Join us with your questions and comments. What priorities should DOT put on the top of the list? And given concerns about funding and state spending, what maybe should go to the back of the list? What can wait? Again, our number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. And I have a couple comments already from listeners, Commissioner Clement, that I want to share with you. But first, as we look at this idea of okay, if you don't get the money, what don't you do? There's a bill in the legislature to repeal the priority status of widening I-93, sponsored by some North Country representatives. What do you think? Should this be lower down on the list, given funding concerns?
I don't think so. For me, you know, I look at it for jobs in the economy and positioning our state. I really believe that I-93 widening project is the state's most important project, and that we need to get that project finished. I-93 is the, you know, the major north-south route in the state. You've heard me say it's the road paved with gold. And when I say that, I mean that the tourism and the dollars that would come in south of our border, that's what I mean when I say that. We need to get the project finished. We made a commitment in the early 80s to do this project, and we need to, in my opinion, get it done post-haste. And it's going to help the North Country when I-93 is completely widened and built out.
Because of the broader economic impacts.
Absolutely. It's going to help everybody in the state, including the North Country, because those people from Massachusetts and all point south are going to be coming up I-93 right into the North Country, right where we want them.
Well, and toward this conversation about, you know, how much you need, what won't happen, dire consequences, possible layoffs of, you know, 700 people. Some state lawmakers, Commissioner Clement, I know you know this, say, Chicken Little, you know, you're coming on too strong. They're skeptical about these crisis predictions, about mass layoffs, less well-plowed roads. How do you feel about that?
It's not Chicken Little. I'm communicating, just like I did in manufacturing a private sector, to my CEO, right? If you have a problem, you state what the problem is. And the legislative budget assistant, the LBA, the negative $48 million figure that I gave you, they foot that number. So it's a real number. We've had a series of one-time fixes that have been used up. We had a $60 million bond in 05 and 06 when O'Leary was here. That got us by 2 years. We had the registration surcharge. That got us by 2 years. We sold the high-level bridge in Portsmouth from the highway fund. From the highway fund to the turnpike, or the turnpike fund paid the highway fund $120 million plus $10 million in interest.
That's right. That was that transfer that Governor Lynch
did. And we just used up the last $27 million in this biennium. So when I say that we have a problem because we haven't fixed that problem for about 10 years now, all the one-time fixes have been used up, and I'm not selling any more assets from one side of the ledger to the other. We have to face the issue, and that's all I'm trying to do. If it makes people uncomfortable, if I'm upsetting people, then so be it. I'm just trying to communicate we have an issue here and we have enough time to figure it out, and that's why I'm out 2 years in advance.
You know, you've said, Commissioner Clement, that you're revenue agnostic, so I won't ask you which sources you prefer because I know you're not going to say that. But what about Senator Rausch's bill to raise the gas tax by 4 cents right away and then peg it to inflation years down the line? Would that give your department what you feel it needs?
Well, if we net about $7.1 million, let's say $7 million per penny, so 7 times 4 is 28. Remember the gap I said is about $48 million. It gets us close. Certainly it helps a lot, and the entire department is grateful for what Senator Rausch is doing in terms of bringing that bill forward. That's great. But it doesn't solve all the issues. And then we have an issue, where does the money go? Does it go to maintenance and operations, which we need about $25 to $30 million a year? Does it go to 93, which if we went out and bonded today, that $250 million bond, it would be about $22 million per year, and that's almost all 4 cents. I told you we needed about another $12 million for paving, another $15 million for bridges, and we also want to help the municipals out with the state aid bridge program, which is another $6.8 million a year. So I know I'm just throwing these millions of dollars around. That's just the nature of the business when you're in transportation. They're big numbers. But, yes, it would help. But we'll have to make tough choices in terms of what we're going to do.
Well, and we talked about this on a legislative roundtable at the beginning of the year. And there was some sentiment on that roundtable, Commissioner Clement, that, you know, you're hitting folks when they're already down. People are just coming out of recession. Making them pay more at the pump really isn't fair. And there has to be other ways to do it. I wonder what you think of that.
I guess I don't know how to answer that question. I mean, we have to decide, actually. Let me back up. We either have to decide whether we're going to fund the program and what level we're going to fund it, and then we'll reorganize the organization accordingly, and we'll do what we do with the funding that's there. It's for me, it's really that simple. It's not – it's just what it is.
Let's take some calls. Okay. We've got some listeners who want to jump in on our conversation. We've got some emails and Facebook comments as well. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. The email is exchange@nhpr.org, and the phone number 1-800-892-6477. And let's go first to Derry. David's on the air. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Go ahead.
I guess more of a comment would be you know, like the expenditure. I mean, the Memorial Bridge in Portsmouth did have to be replaced, but you look and you hear on, you know, NPR, for example, that, you know, they rehab the placard for the bridge, and, you know, the expenditure there was, I want to say it was like $100,000 or something like that, for a placard, you know, saying that this is a bridge. And, you know, that's money that could go towards actual, you know, hardware.
So do the basics, David, but maybe there's some frills that could be gotten rid of there. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thanks for calling in, David. What do you think, Commissioner Clement?
I think he's right. That's a great point. I actually think it was more than that, David. I think it was around $300,000 to have all the placards done, but it was part of the historical resources. We were mandated that you had to do that. So we're taking down the old bridge, which has historical value. And the longer I'm in this job, the more I'm seeing that we do have structures around not only New Hampshire that are around the country that once they're gone, the new modern structures are put up, the history is gone. But
who mandated that historical?
The Department of Historical Resources. That was part of both Maine and New Hampshire, and I think there was a federal component that, you know, we want to preserve those plaques. They were for the World War I veterans, and I think it's important. But
and
it's
how much of that money was federal money, by the way?
Well, I think it was all federal. I mean, it was the bridge was $81.4 million, and it was split 50-50 by Maine and New Hampshire. So Maine paid half of that, you know, half of that restoration project.
All right, David, thank you very much for the call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's a comment from Facebook from John who says, raise the gas tax tomorrow and change it to a ton-mile rate where heavier vehicles pay more. John says, change the laws to prevent raiding the highway fund and enact a vehicle miles traveled tax so the big drivers pay more. Easy. John says. And thank you, John, for those comments. There's three suggestions in there. First of all, raise the gas tax and change it to a ton-mile rate where heavier vehicles pay more. Do other states do that, Commissioner Clement?
Oregon actually has a pilot program that they're working on now, which is it's a vehicle miles traveled tax.
John's second suggestion.
Yeah,
how does that work?
I don't know exactly all the ins and outs. They're working through that now. They have 5,000 volunteers that have signed up for the program where you don't pay a gas tax when you go fill up your vehicle, but you pay so much based on how many miles you drive. And there are a number of different ways that you can do it. And nationwide, we don't have a plan, but Oregon is leading the charge here. Actually, Oregon was the first state in the country to have a statewide gas tax, and they're leading the charge here in terms of having a VMT or a vehicle miles travel tax as well.
And I know other states have looked at that, but it's pretty controversial because there's a big brother aspect to it.
That's
you know,
right.
Somebody's tracking how far you've gone, maybe even where you've gone. The other thing is, some folks who can't afford to live right downtown because it's expensive or right within a particular town or city have to live far out. And drive to their jobs, and you know, through no fault of their own, they're driving more.
Right, and I think whenever
this fairness issue,
whenever
right?
this is figured out, and I suspect when you look, if you fast forward in the future, some years ahead from now, 10 or 15 or 20 years from now, it'll be a slow regression. Right, we'll have the gas tax or whatever it may be at the time, and that'll slowly get replaced by a vehicle miles travel tax, and that's going to morph and change. And vehicle miles travel tax, it could be that, depending on where you live, that you're just paying so much per mile, regardless of what type of road you're driving on. In some areas where there's a lot of congestion, like in big cities, that you're going to pay more to be riding on a road downtown, for example, versus a country road. But I think there will be equity. I can't imagine the day that we would, you know, you'd pay more, substantially more vehicle miles travel tax than versus what you're paying today with a gas tax. I've got to believe there's going to be parity there.
Well, and his other point, change the laws to prevent raiding the highway fund. This has come up before. Some people say, including some lawmakers, that, you know, DOT might not be so hard up for cash, but there are other agencies pulling from DOT's budget, including the State Safety Agency. What do you think about that? The idea that I think somebody once said that DOT's budget is being used like an ATM for other uses.
Well, I mean, what I've said this before, DOT is not the highway fund. The highway fund's not DOT. The Department of Safety has every right statutorily to live off the highway fund as we do. And what I say there is that, you know, we build the roads and the Department of Safety, they're a great partner. They keep them safe. And, you know, that's a decision by the legislature whether Department of Safety should be in the highway fund or not. It's not the Department of Safety, or it's not, you know, the Department of Transportation. And Commissioner Brothermas and I are locked in on that. We both feel the same way.
Yeah, so if lawmakers are concerned that one budget's being raided for another, then they can change those laws. That's not
right.
Really your jurisdiction.
We can't change the law. That's up for policymakers. That's for the legislature, not for commissioners.
Lots of thoughts there, John. Thanks a lot for that Facebook comment. Our Facebook page is NHPR Exchange, all one word. You can comment there. You can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's an email from Malcolm in Holderness. He says, has the time arrived to start redlisting our most deteriorated secondary roads, suffering from extreme frost heaves, broken pavement, lack of ditch maintenance, and intruding vegetation? Malcolm, it's an interesting question. We talked earlier, Commissioner Clement, about redlisted bridges. What about redlisted roads?
Well, I think we call redlisted roads now poor condition roads.
And it doesn't have quite the same cachet as redlisted.
Yeah, it doesn't, but when you ride over it, you can feel it in terms of the condition of the road. That is an interesting statement. That's the first time that anybody's ever said that before. I know there was some talk last session about taking some type of red dot and putting it on a red list bridge. So if you were one of the lawmakers were looking at that, so if you're approaching a red list bridge, you'd actually see that it's a red list bridge because it has a red dot. That didn't go anywhere, and I couldn't imagine that you'd want to do something similar for a road. But I guess we call our red listed roads poor condition roads, and we have about 37%. We're about 1,600 miles today. So interesting question.
Thanks, Malcolm, for the email. Back to the phones, and this is Dan calling in from Lyme. Hi, Dan. You're on the exchange with Commissioner Clement. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking the call. The fact that there hasn't been a gas tax increase since 1992, strikes me as absolutely crazy. On the cost side, the Engineering News Record Construction Cost Index has been going up, 5 to 10% a year. At 5% a year over 20 years, we get, half the purchasing power. At 8% a year over 20 years, we get less than a quarter of the purchasing power. On the revenue side from the gas tax, fuel economy is up 20 to 30%.
That's right.
Vehicle miles traveled is stable or down. The combination is we're lucky if we can do a quarter of what we used to be able to do. And, it's seems to me that, it's better to renew roads and bridges when they're in good condition. If we repave, renew every few years, 5 to 10 years, it's, 50,000 a mile.
That's right.
If
wow.
if we wait 20 years, it's millions per mile.
1.1 million to be exact. You're right,
yeah.
Dan.
And this stalling around, and not raising the gas tax, when we all demand, whether we're the Koch brothers or the 99%, that we be able to drive on the roads, during snowy conditions and so forth, it's just amazing that we're not raising the gas tax and, funding this program.
Okay, Dan, thanks for the call. I'm sure you're agreeing with him, Commissioner Clement.
I am. I'm just from a revenue perspective, I'm agreeing with him that it's the buying power from 1992 is not there, and we say it's less than half. And
because that's the last time we raised it.
Yes, and if you look at Dan also mentioned the fuel economy. If you look back not so many years ago, if you were driving a Chevy Impala with a big V8 engine, 15 miles per gallon, you were contributing to the New Hampshire Highway Fund of about $495 per year. Now, if you look at the Chevy Volt that gets 230 miles per gallon, you're contributing to the New Hampshire Highway Fund to about $30 per year.
Oh, wow, so that's a big difference.
$500 per year per vehicle versus $30 per year per vehicle for a new Chevy Volt. So when you look at, the cost of liquid asphalt cement going up 460% in that time frame, and if you look at road salt has gone up 123% since the year 1992, salaries and benefits and all our equipment and trucks and heat and all that, class 20 consumables have all gone up. We're doing more with less.
Well, and talking about revenue sources, and again, you agree with Dan's point on the costs going up, but as you said, you're not advocating one particular revenue source over another. Here's another source, though, that I did want to ask you about that, as you know, some in the legislature are looking at. That's expanded gambling in New Hampshire with a good chunk of the proceeds promise to infrastructure. How stable a revenue source is this, Commissioner Clement?
Well, I'm certainly not an expert in this area, but I think that if let's say there was a casino bill that passed, and we, let's say hypothetically that we built a casino somewhere in the state, and that some level, and I think the number was 50% of the funds would go towards transportation, and I think it was like $50 million. What we could do is we could tie our capital program to a casino. So if the casino revenues went up, we do more paving, we do more bridge repair that year, and if it goes down for some reason because of the economy, we do less capital work. So I don't think I'd want to tie a bond, like an I-93 bond, to a casino, but I would certainly tie, you know, construction projects to it. And well, we can ramp that up and ramp that down depending on what the revenues would be like.
This does get away from the user fee concept that the gas tax and road tolls and so forth represent, a concept that people are comfortable with, right? Because they say, okay, people using the roads are paying for the roads. The casinos gets away from that.
It does. And again, it goes back to what I was saying, that I'm revenue agnostic. I'm just presenting the problem. You know, it's really the domain of the legislature to determine where the funds come from. It's not me. It's not commissioners. We're there to present the case, and that's what I'm trying to do.
Here's another email that just came in from Will in Concord. He says, I would like to know if DOT has done any analysis of revenue potential from leasing state-owned rights-of-way for underground utilities like gas pipelines and Canadian electricity. This came up also on our legislative roundtable. Senator Bradley, Republican of Wolfboro, said that this might be something to look at for highway funds.
We have not. There have been bills that have been in the last few sessions for this, but the department has not specifically gone out and done the calculations. But what I can tell you is that we have a methane gas line that goes from the Turnkey landfill in Rochester all the way up to the University of New Hampshire on the Spalding Turnpike, and we take on a yearly basis less than $20,000. So it's not huge numbers, and that's probably, 25 miles from end to end. So it's not huge dollars. I know the state of Maine was looking at, you know, an energy corridor as well on Interstate 95. And again, the numbers weren't astronomical, but every bit helps. So
there'd be a cost involved, too, in terms of putting those lines underneath or those
pipes
underneath,
initially,
although you wouldn't bear that cost.
Right, initially, but over time, if you got paid some fee based on the amount of, you know, electrons that went back and forth or the amount of, you know, gas that flowed through that line, for example, then, you know, it could help.
All right. We will take more of your emails, calls, Facebook comments after a short break. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Keep those emails short. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. We'll be right back.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, an update on the West Virginia chemicals spill and the safety of water supplies in other states. Then how slavery shaped many of America's elite universities. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from Lewis Carno & Company, communications and public relations, proud partner of SATA Airlines, with weekly flights to the Azores. Information at sata.pt. And Republic, New Hampshire's original certified local farm-to-table restaurant, breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily. Elm Street, Manchester, online at republiccafe.com. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, New Hampshire activist and writer Dan Weeks examines poverty in America 50 years after President Johnson's war against it began. Today, we're talking with Transportation Commissioner Christopher Clement about the state of New Hampshire's roads, bridges, rail, and other infrastructure. Join us by calling 1-800-892-6477. Send a short email to exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. All one word. And Commissioner Clement, let's go right back to our listeners. And Kevin's calling in. Go ahead, Kevin. You're on the air and welcome.
Yes, good morning. Thank
morning.
You. I was hoping to ask the panel what they thought about roads and their conditions and the effect it might have on tourism. I am in the hospitality business up in the Mount Washington Valley. And while Route 16 has had major improvements and is in fairly good condition, Route 302 over from Maine, where we do get, which is, I think, a major entry point for the Mount Washington Valley. That road is in absolutely horrible condition and getting worse by the day.
Well, what do you hear from folks, Kevin?
That it's getting more and more difficult to drive those roads, that they're not enjoyable. So I was wondering if they think it has an effect on people heading to other tourism-related areas as opposed to, say, the Mount Washington Valley.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling in, Kevin. Go ahead, Commissioner Clement.
Well, it's too bad Jeff Rose, the Commissioner of Department of Resources and Economic Development, wasn't sitting right beside me. I don't know the answer to that precisely, Kevin, but I have to expect that in some cases, yes, that people, if the road is that bad, that people might go somewhere else. I mean, hopefully somewhere else within our great state of New Hampshire, but go somewhere else because they don't want to drive down a certain road. They may, if they have a small car or if they have a sports car, for example, that has low ground clearance, they may not want to ride on it or may not want to get it dirty if there's a lot of potholes. But, I mean, another thing that I've said in the past is our goal at the department is to pave 500 miles of roads every year. So every 10 years we have fresh roads in the state. In the last few years, we've only been able to do about 300 miles of roads, and it's our goal to get back up to that 500 mile of paving mark per year. And then the Route 302s, which is a primary arterial, what we call a Tier 2 road, we'd be able to pave that on a more frequent basis. So you're right, Kevin. We understand, and we're just, again, that's what we're doing. That's why we're here today. We're just trying to communicate the need.
Thanks a lot for the call, Kevin. Here's an email that came in from Peter, who says, I hope you'll be discussing the two rail studies underway, the New Hampshire Capital Corridor study to evaluate the feasibility of extending passenger service beyond Lowell to Nashua, Manchester, and Concord. Also, the study to evaluate the extension of passenger rail service beyond Haverhill to Plastow. Additionally, the success of the Downeaster service, Boston to Brunswick, 535,000 passengers annually, and the Boston-Logan Express, over 200,000 passengers, needs to be mentioned. Peter says the success of these projects kills the argument that New Hampshire is a rural state and that there is not a population base to support public transportation. Let's talk about that. A couple points that Peter brings up. First of all, the broader philosophical argument that he says is not true, that New Hampshire is a rural state, there's not a population base to support public transportation. What do you think?
Well, I'll start off with the Boston Express comment. The average daily ridership this year, the average monthly ridership this year in 2013 was about 45,000 riders per month. And if you look at since 2007, the inception of the Boston Express, it's about 2.6 million passengers. And the metric that the industry uses, what they call the fare box recovery rate, is 88%. So almost 90% fare box recovery rate, meaning it's paying 90% of its costs. In the country, the national average for these types of services are about 25% fare box recovery rate.
So that's a big difference.
We're more than 3.5 times. Boston Express is the most successful New Starts transit program in the entire United States of America. And to the caller's point, this is what we call rural New Hampshire. Boston Express, most successful New Starts in the entire country. Again, fare box recovery rate hovering right around 90%.
So there's a subsidy, but it's small, especially compared to other services.
Yeah, exactly. So it's doing very well. To the rail studies, yes, we're looking at Plastow and the New Hampshire Capital Corridor. The New Hampshire Capital Corridor study will be finished December of this year. So mid-December of 2014, the study will be done. It was about $3.7 million. Both Federal Transit Administration, FTA, and Federal Railroad Administration, FRA, they came together first time where they actually worked together on a grant like this. So we're doing the study. The initial results, they're draft, but the initial results show positive ridership in both Nashua and Manchester. And looking at the potential of both of those cities, Manchester and Nashua, having two rail stations in each one of those locations. But the ridership thus far looks good.
That's the study, though.
That's
we don't know that for sure.
The ridership results, again, ridership results in the study look promising.
There was a letter to the Concord Monitor over the weekend that raised this point about, you saying the department needs more money. This person said, why are we spending money on, for example, studying rail? I mean, rail has been studied here in New Hampshire. Maybe we just shouldn't go there right now, given the intense needs that you described earlier. I wonder what you think about that.
Well, I think it comes down to, you know, there are some people in the state that feel like we need rail, right? And we're a democracy. And the reason why there's this rail study is because there was a large group of people that stood up and said, listen, I think that, you know, we should study this, see if the ridership numbers would be there. So we as a state, DOT, competed. We worked with the New Hampshire Rail Transit Authority. We competed nationally for this grant, and we were awarded this grant. And, you know, at the end of the day, the numbers are going to be what the numbers are. I'm a numbers guy. I don't get emotional about this stuff. The facts are the facts. The numbers are the numbers. So let's see what the numbers are, and then we can have a discussion in terms of whether we move forward with New Hampshire Capital Corridor or not, and what the costs are going to be, and where, you know, where the money is going to come from. So that's another whole discussion. Where, you know, where would the operational costs come to run the New Hampshire Capital Corridor from, you know, from, let's say, Manchester down to, you know, down south into Boston.
Where has the money come from for these studies?
Well, it's interesting because the person that wrote this article, Dick Lemieux, used to work for the Federal Highway Administration here in Concord. So Dick would know more than anyone else on this. But we use congestion mitigation air quality funds. These are federal funds that look at alternative modes to reduce compression, congestion, and improve air quality. So these are CMAQ funds. They're federal funds that were used to do this, you know, this study.
So those are dedicated toward that. It's not like you could have taken those dollars and put them into, you know, fixing a bridge.
That's right. That's right. It's for congestion mitigation, air quality, to reduce congestion and improve air quality. So again, this project competed with others. And the people on the committee thought that this project was important, and that's why I got the funding.
Well, thanks for that email, Peter. And here's another one. This is from Claire in Durham. She says, transportation also includes other modes of transit, trains, buses, bicycles. We've talked about trains and buses some. But Claire says, what are your plans for these alternative transits, especially given climate change, a growing population? It seems like adding bike lanes when redoing highways would be an easy accommodation. I'm a grad student at UNH studying climate change and an avid cyclist. Claire, thanks a lot for that. And, you know, we haven't talked about bicycle lanes and so forth. Not great weather for biking right now, but 6 months out of the year, at least,
right,
you could bike to get where you need to go.
Well, I actually saw some people out this weekend on their mountain bikes that had studded tires, so you could use it more than six months out of the year. But, Claire, great question. That's something the department looks at more and more. We're working on a project right now in your area in Durham, Newmarket, Route 108 between Durham and Newmarket. That road will be completely rebuilt, and there will be bike lanes, 4-foot bike lanes on each side. Also, the Pease Development Authority, there's a multi-use path that's being being built early spring. That should be done midsummer. That goes between the PDA and off of Route 33. In Greenland, so that's another one there. But, you know, it all comes down to choices, right? So I'm sure some people on the phone will say, why would we spend money on bike lanes? Why would we not put that in the paving? And again, it all comes down to choices. And there are different buckets of funding. It's not just one bucket of funding where you could say we're going to use that entire DOT budget just to pave roads or just to fix bridges.
When you're talking about federal money.
Absolutely. Yeah.
State money, you probably have a little more.
State money, we have a betterment program, which is 3 cents of the gas tax, which equates to about $22.5 million a year. And that we put back 100% back into roads and bridges. You know, $12 million of that $22.5 million goes out and just does paving. But there are certain categories where funding has to be spent and you have to follow that federal protocol.
Claire, thanks a lot for the email.
Great question.
And the email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Keep those emails coming. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And the phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Betsy's been waiting in Hanover. Hi, Betsy. Thanks for being on the air with us.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to clarify a point that was made about the casino revenue in New Hampshire. Actually, if a casino is approved, there will be only a one-time licensing fee of $80 million to be used by the state, and any revenues that come in later will actually go to the casino, not to the state of New Hampshire. And I think we have to think about the long-term effects of a casino, added expenses of families being affected by gambling addiction and such. So it's really just that one-time lump sum, and it won't be there after the casino is up and running.
I don't know, Betsy. Wouldn't there be annual revenues of some sort to the state from a casino?
Apparently not. Apparently the money that is being anticipated is that $80 million, which is a one-time fee.
Yeah, and I've heard about that, but I'm not quite sure about that, Commissioner Clement. And I know this isn't your area of expertise. We will be doing casino shows certainly down the road as the bills come forward, but I'm guessing that the state would get some sort of annual benefit.
Yeah, again, this is I'm the least knowledgeable person in this building on casinos in terms of revenue that would come in, but I would think that if we were going to go through this, there would be annual revenue coming in. That's the way I understood it last session when we were looking at this, when we were looking at, you know, what could we do if the casino was built and if there was a revenue source coming in, how would we use the funding? And that's what I said earlier, that if it was a funding level that went up and down based on if people were using the facility or not, we could structure the capital program based on the ebbs and flows of the casino funding.
That's tough, though, because I would imagine when, okay, let's say times are good and the casino program, whatever it is, and Betsy, we should definitely clarify that. Thank you. When times are good, you may say, all right, let's use this money to fix road number X. And then the funding goes down the next year, but you've already hired the people, you've already signed the contracts, you've already bought the paving materials. You know what I'm saying, Commissioner Clement? Doesn't seem like road construction is a good area for funding that could go up and down.
Well, I think you'd use it in arrears. So if you took in 1 year, you took in $50 million, then that $50 million would go towards next year's projects. And you'd go out and you'd let $50 million worth of paving and bridge projects out, for example. So, and if the next year it was less, then you'd advertise less. You'd peg it to whatever that revenue source was. That's more or less how we're doing it now, budget by budget, you know, every 2 years. So we're adjusting the amount of work that we do based on what the budget is.
Betsy, thanks a lot for that phone call. And I wanted to ask you, Commissioner Clement, towards the end of the year last year, there was some excitement about renovation of the big, big rest areas off of Interstate 93 going north and south, making them a lot more of a destination with private investment from restaurant entrepreneur Alex Ray of The Common Man, for folks who have heard of that. How involved is your department in this, and what does this mean for DOT?
Right, great question. We're very involved. It's the New Hampshire Turnpike system, so it's on the Turnpike. So this is a great example of a public-private partnership, and with Rusty McClear and Alex Ray, who are, you know, just great. They're very well known in the state of New Hampshire. Very successful business people, give back to the community, you know, in many, many ways.
What's this going to be like? How is this different now? I mean, now you go in, there's a giant liquor store, and there's a little teeny sort of rest area where you can go to the bathroom and buy a Coke.
Well, it's going to change this way. So I'm kind of laughing because you're saying the liquor store is giant. So the liquor store is right now about 8,000 square feet. It's going to go to 20,000 square feet. So if you think the liquor store is giant now, then it's going to be larger
than
giant.
Get lost in there for days.
So liquor store is going to be about 20,000 square feet. So it's going to be larger. Then you're going to have a, you know, there's going to be a diner. There's going to be a restaurant. There's going to be a place to get coffee. There's going to be a New Hampshire goods section, of course. It's going to have a New Hampshire look and feel. If you haven't seen the schematics online, you should log on to our website and look at them. You know, New Hampshire fieldstone facade. Rusty and Alex just did an incredible job with their architect just designing this. It's going to look like it's been there for 100 years when you go by. It's going to be a destination. We're also going to have fuel as well. There's going to be 12 fueling stations and also car diesel. We're also looking at also car charging electrical stations. That was something that came in after the fact. I think that Mayor Lozo in Nashua was actually talking to me about it one day, and that was one of the things that we didn't look at initially. So thank you, Mayor, for bringing that up if you're listening. So that's going to be included as well. There's going to be a pet area where you can walk your pets around, but it's going to be, in my view, the model for welcome centers, not only in New Hampshire, the Northeast, but across the country.
Sounds pretty grand.
It's really, really great. And they're both sides, northbound, southbound, are going to open on or before April of 2015. And I can tell you that they're moving along out there at a very quick pace, and I wouldn't be surprised if Alex and Rusty open up before April of 15.
Well, and there were other smaller state rest areas that got chopped during the extreme budget crisis that we had. That's right. A couple years ago, had to be closed down. Often when I go to visit family in Keene, somebody has to go to the bathroom two-thirds of the way to Keene, and yes, indeed, that Route 9 rest area has been closed. What are the hopes, given this big, big project on I-93, Commissioner Clement, for the smaller projects?
So that you just made me think of another important point. The big project on 9A3 was all private funds, So the state Transportation Department turnpikes will receive on the low end about $700,000 per year for 35 years, and it will go up based on how you know, the Welcome Center
does. So you guys had to invest nothing, and you make money off of it.
Absolutely, yes. So that's a very important distinction. So that's turnpike. Now, on the other side of the DOT is the highway fund, and these Welcome Centers that we're talking about, Antrim, I think, is the one that you're talking about, was part of cuts two budgets ago when the highway fund, again, was in serious situation. We had to look at what are we going to do and what we're not going to do, and that goes back to the point that I made earlier. People and programs will be affected. That's a type of a program where we had to reduce the amount of welcome centers that we have, unfortunately. We're working on a study. It actually should go out on the streets pretty soon, and I should have that date with me, and I apologize I don't, but we're looking at studying all 16 welcome centers in the state, having an outside firm that's expert in this area, look at them, see if they're needed anymore, see from a strategic placement point of view, are they near a McDonald's or a Burger King or a Dunkin' Donuts where you don't necessarily need to have it anymore. And that's going to be viewed. We should have that done in the next 9 to 10 months.
So which ones should we beef up? Which ones should we close permanently and say thanks but no thanks?
Right.
And
the ones that we're going to keep, I want to fix them up so they're representative of the state, not the way they are today.
Okay. Well, Commissioner Clement, what's the next step for you on this funding issue as the legislature really kicks into high gear?
I think I'm just going to stay the course. I'm going to continue to educate and be out speaking to whoever wants to listen so they understand, you know, where the money is, where the money is going, and that we are being, you know, fiscally conservative with it. I'm a fiscally conservative guy. I don't like spending any more on taxes than anyone else does. I'm a New Hampshire born, raised, educated, so I get it. So we take it very, very seriously. And the whole front office are conservative folks trying to stretch the New Hampshire dollar as far as we can go. But we've stretched it as far as we can go.
It's good to talk to you. Thank you very much for being here.
Great being here. Thank you.
Christopher Clement, Commissioner of the New Hampshire Department of Transportation. He previously served as Director of the Governor's Office of Economic Stimulus. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, New Hampshire writer and activist Dan Weeks traveled to some of the nation's poorest areas to examine the state of American poverty, the causes and consequences. 50 years after President Johnson declared war on poverty, we'll talk to Dan Weeks about what he found, chronicled in a new series of articles in The Atlantic. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, the Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 o'clock. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield in New Hampshire, proud to support a broad range of nonprofits like New Horizons for New Hampshire. Details at newhorizonsnh.org. And the McAuliffe Shepherd Discovery Center, featuring a new exhibit on earthquakes, opened Thursday through Sunday, and Martin Luther King Day. Information at starhop.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio. WEVO, Concord,
89.1. WEVS, Nashua,
88.3. WEVH, Hanover,
91.3. WEVN, Keene, 90.7. WEVC, Gorham,
107.1. WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook,
90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton,
91.9. And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Last week, more than 7,000 gallons of a toxic chemical leaked into West Virginia's Elk River. The accident caused contamination of the water supply in 9 counties. Since then, tens of thousands of West Virginians have been without running water.